Hello, everybody. Welcome to our reading of Savitri and Infinite Conversations. Today we are going to repeat reading Canto 4, Vision and the Boon, from the Book of the Divine Mother, which is Book 3. So that would be on page 334, if you're following along on the latest version of this. And this is the last canto of the story of Savitri, or the story of Ashwapati in this work. So after this canto, we will be switching over to the second half of the work, which is the story of Savitri herself. And we'll start with a meditation.
Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, Canto 4, the Vision and the Boon. Then suddenly there rose a sacred stir. Amid the lifeless silence of the void, in a solitude and an immensity, a sound came quivering like a loved footfall, heard in the listening spaces of the soul. A touch perturbed his fibers with delight. An influence had approached the mortal range. A boundless heart was near his longing heart. A mystic form enveloped his earthly shape. All at her contact broke from silence seal. Spirit and body thrilled, identified, linked in the grasp of an unspoken joy. Mind, members, life were merged in ecstasy. Intoxicated as with nectarous rain, his nature's passioning stretches flowed to her, flashing with lightnings, mad with luminous wine. All was a limitless sea that heaved to the moon. A divinizing stream possessed his veins. His body's cells awoke to spirit sense. Each nerve became a burning thread of joy. Tissue and flesh partook beatitude. Alight, the dun, unplumbed subconscious caves thrilled with the presence of her longed-for tread and filled with flickering crests and praying tongues. Even lost in slumber, mute, inanimate, his very body answered to her power. The one he worshipped was within him now, flame pure, ethereal tressed. A mighty face appeared, and lips moved by immortal words. Lids, wisdom's leaves, drooped over rapture's orbs.
A marble monument of ponderings shone a forehead, sights crypt, and large like ocean's gaze towards heaven. Two tranquil eyes of boundless thought looked into man's and saw the god to come. A shape was seen on the threshold mind. A voice absolute and wise in the heart's chambers spoke. O son of strength, who climbst creation's peaks, no soul is thy companion in the light. Alone thou standest at the eternal doors. What thou hast won is thine, but ask no more. O spirit aspiring in an ignorant frame, O voice arisen from the inconscient world, how shalt thou speak for men whose hearts are dumb? Make purblind earth the soul's seer vision's home, or lighten the burden of the senseless globe. I am the mystery beyond reach of mind. I am the goal of the travail of the sun. My fire and sweetness are the cause of life, but too immense my danger and my joy. Awake not the immeasurable descent. Speak not my secret name to hostile time. Man is too weak to bear the infinite's weight. Truth born too soon might break the imperfect earth, leave the all-saying power to hew its way. In thy single vast achievement reign apart, helping the world with thy great lonely days. I ask thee not to merge thy heart aflame in the immobile's wide uncaring bliss. Turned from the fruitless motion of the years, deserting the fierce labor of the worlds, aloof from beings, lost in the alone. How shalt thy mighty spirit brook repose while death is still unconquered on the earth and time a field of suffering and pain? Thy soul was born to share the laden force. Obey thy nature and fulfill thy fate. Accept the difficulty and godlike toil, for the slow-paced, omniscient purpose, live.
The enigma's knot is tied in humankind. A lightning from the heights that think and plan, plowing the air of life with vanishing trails, man, soul awake in an unconscious world, aspires in vain to change the cosmic dream. Arrived from some half-luminous beyond, he is a stranger in the mindless vasts, a traveler in his oft-shifting home amid the tread of many infinities. He has pitched a tent of life in desert space. Heaven's fixed regard beholds him from above. In the house of nature, a perturbing guest, a voyager twixt thoughts in constant shores, a hunter of unknown and beautiful powers, a nomad of the far mysterious light, in the wide ways, a little spark of God. Against his spirit, all is in dire league. A titan influence stops his Godward gaze. Around him hungers the unpitying void. The eternal darkness seeks him with her hands. Inscrutable energies drive him and deceive. Immense, implacable deities oppose. An inert soul and a somnambulist force have made a world estranged from life and thought. The dragon of the dark foundations keeps unalterable the law of chance and death. On his long way through time and circumstance, the gray-hued, riddling, nether shadow sphinx, her dreadful paws upon the swallowing sands, awaits him, armed with the soul-slaying word. Across his path sits the dim camp of night. His day is a moment in perpetual time. He is the prey of the minutes and the hours.
Assailed on earth and unassured of heaven, descended here unhappy and sublime, a link between the demigod and the beast, he knows not his own greatness nor his aim. He has forgotten why he has come and whence. His spirit and his members are at war. His heights break off too low to reach the skies. His mass is buried in the animal mire. A strange antinomy is his nature's rule. A riddle of opposites is made his field. Freedom, he asks, but needs to live in bonds. He has need of darkness to perceive some light, and need of grief to feel a little bliss. He has need of death to find a greater life. All sides he sees and turns to every call. He has no certain light by which to walk. His life is a blind man's buff, a hide and seek. He seeks himself, and from himself he runs. Meeting himself, he thinks it other than he. Always he builds, but finds no constant ground. Always he journeys, but nowhere arrives. He would guide the world, himself he cannot guide. He would save his soul, his life he cannot save. The light his soul had brought, his mind has lost. All he has learned is soon again in doubt. A sun to him seems the shadow of his thoughts. Then all is shadow again, and nothing true. Unknowing what he does or whither he tends, he fabricates signs of the real in ignorance. He has hitched his mortal error to truth's star. Wisdom attracts him with her luminous masks, but never has he seen the face behind. A giant ignorance surrounds his lore. Assigned to meet the cosmic mystery in the dumb figure of a material world, his passport of entry false and his personage, he is compelled to be what he is not. He obeys the inconscience he had come to rule and sinks in matter to fulfill his soul.
Awakened from her lower driven forms, the Earth Mother gave her forces to his hands, and painfully he guards the heavy trust. His mind is a lost torchbearer on her roads. Illumining breath to think and plasm to feel, he labors with his slow and skeptic brain, helping with the reason's vacillating fires, helped by the reason's vacillating fires, to make his thought and will a magic door for knowledge to enter the darkness of the world, and love to rule a realm of strife and hate. A mind impotent to reconcile heaven and earth, and tied to matter with a thousand bonds, he lifts himself to be a conscious God. Even when a glory of wisdom crowns his brow, when mind and spirit shed a grandiose ray to exalt this product of the sperm and gene, this alchemist's miracle from plasm and gas, and he who shared the animals run and crawl, lifts his thought stature to the immortal's heights, his life still keeps the human middle way. His body he resigns to death and pain, abandoning matter, his too heavy charge. A thaumaturge skeptic of miracles, a spirit left sterile of its occult power by an unbelieving brain and credulous heart, he leaves the world to end where it began. His work unfinished, he claims a heavenly prize. Thus has he missed creation's absolute. Halfway he stops his star of destiny. A vast and vain long-tried experiment, an ill-served high conception doubtfully done, the world's life falters on not seeing its goal. A zigzag towards unknown dangerous ground, ever repeating its habitual walk, ever retreating after marches long and hardiest victories without sure result, drawn endlessly, an inconclusive game.
In an ill-fitting and voluminous robe, a radiant purpose still conceals its face. A mighty blindness stumbles, hoping on, feeding its strength on gifts of luminous chance. Because the human instrument has failed, the Godhead frustrate sleeps within its seed, a spirit entangled in the forms it made. His failure is not failure whom God leads. Through all the slow, mysterious march goes on. An immutable power has made this mutable world. Self-fulfilling transcendence treads man's road. The driver of the soul upon its path, it knows its steps, its ways is inevitable. And how shall the end be vain when God is guide? However man's mind may tire or fail his flesh, a will prevails, canceling his conscious choice. The goal recedes, a bornless vastness calls, retreating into an immense unknown. There is no end to the world's stupendous march. There is no rest for the embodied soul. It must live on, describe all time's huge curve. An influx presses from the close beyond, forbidding to him rest and earthly ease. Till he has found himself, he cannot pause. A light there is that leads, a power that aids. Unmarked, unfelt, it sees in him and acts. Ignorant, he forms the all-conscient in his depths. Human, looks up to superhuman peaks, A borrower of supernatural's gold, he paves his road to immortality. The high gods look on man and watch and choose today's impossibles for the future's base. His transient trembles with the eternal's touch, his barrier seed beneath the infinite's dread. The immortals have their entries in his life, the ambassadors of the unseen draw near.
A splendor sullied by the mortal air, love passes through his heart, a wandering guest. Beauty surrounds him for a magic hour. He has visits of a large revealing joy. Brief widenesses release him from himself, enticing toward a glory ever in front. Hopes of a deathless sweetness lure and leave. His mind is crossed by strange discovering fires. Rare intimations lift his stumbling speech to a moment's kinship with the eternal word. A mask of wisdom circles through his brain, perturbing him with glimpses half divine. He lays his hands sometimes on the unknown. He communes sometimes with eternity. A strange and grandiose symbol was his birth, an immortality and spirit room, and pure perfection, and a shadowless bliss are this afflicted creature's mighty fate. In him, the Earth Mother sees draw near the change foreshadowed in her dumb and fiery depths, a godhead drawn from her transmuted limbs, an alchemy of heaven on nature's base. Adept of the self-born unfailing line, leave not the light to die the ages bore. Help still humanity's blind and suffering life. Obey thy spirit's wide omnipotent urge. A witness to God's parley with the night. It leaned compassionate from immortal calm and housed desire, the troubled seed of things. Ascent to thy high self. Create. Endure. Cease not from knowledge. Let thy toil be vast. No more can earthly limits pen thy force. Equal thy work with long unending times.
Traveler upon the bare eternal heights, tread still the difficult and dateless path, joining the cycles with its austere curve, measured for man by the initiate gods. My light shall be in thee, my strength thy force. Let not the impatient Titan drive thy heart. Ask not the imperfect fruit, the partial prize. Only one boon to greaten thy spirit demand. Only one joy to raise thy kind desire. Above blind fate and the antagonist powers, moveless there stands a high, unchanging will. To its omnipotence, leave thy work's result. All things shall change in God's transfiguring hour. August and sweet sank, hushed, that mighty voice. Nothing now moved in the vast brooding space. A stillness came upon the listening world. A mute immensity of the eternal's peace. But Ashwapati's heart replied to her, a cry amid the silence of the vasts. How shall I rest content with mortal days and the dull measure of terrestrial things? I, who have seen behind the cosmic mask the glory and the beauty of thy face. Hard is the doom to which thou bindest to thy sons. How long shall our spirits battle with the night and bear defeat and the brute yoke of death? We who are vessels of a deathless force and builders of the godhead of the race. Or if it is thy work I do below, amid the error and waste of human life, in the vague light of man's half-conscious mind, why breaks not in some distant gleam of thee? Ever the centuries and millenniums pass. Where in the grayness is thy coming's ray? Where is the thunder of thy victory's wings? Only we hear the feet of passing gods.
A plan, a plan in the occult eternal mind mapped out to backward and prophetic sight. The eons ever repeat their changeless round. The cycles all rebuild and ever aspire. All we have done is ever still to do. All breaks and all renews and is the same. Huge revolutions of life's fruitless gyre, the newborn ages perish like the old, as if the sad enigma kept its right till all is done for which the scene was made. Too little the strength that now with us is born, too faint the light that steals through nature's lids, too scant the joy with which she buys our pain. In a brute world that knows not its own sense, thought racked upon the wheel of birth we live, the instruments of an impulse not our own, move to achieve with our heart's blood for price, half knowledge, half creations that soon tire. A foiled immortal soul in perishing limbs, baffled and beaten back, we labor still. Annulled, frustrated, spent, we still survive. In anguish, we labor that from us may rise a larger seeing man with nobler heart, a golden vessel of the incarnate truth, the executor of the divine attempt, equipped to wear the earthly body of God. Communicant and prophet and lover and king. I know that thy creation cannot fail, for even through the mists of mortal thought, infallible are thy mysterious steps. And though necessity dons the garb of chance, hidden in the blind shifts of fate, she keeps the slow, calm logic of infinity's pace and the inviolate sequence of its will. All life is fixed in an ascending scale, and adamantine is the evolving law. In the beginning is prepared the close.
This strange irrational product of the mire, its compromise between the beast and God, is not the crown of thy miraculous world. I know there shall inform the inconscient cells, as one with nature and at height with heaven, a spirit vast as the containing sky, and swept with ecstasy from invisible founts, a God come down and greater by the fall. A power arose out of my slumber cell. Abandoning the tardy limp of the hours and the inconstant blink of mortal sight, there where the thinker sleeps in too much light and intolerant flames, the lone all witnessing eye, hearing the word of fate from silence heart in the endless moment of eternity, it saw from timelessness the works of time. Overpassed were the leaden formulas of the mind, overpowered the obstacle of mortal space. The unfolding image showed the things to come. A giant dance of Shiva tore the past. There was a thunder as of worlds that fall. Earth was o'errun with fire and the roar of death, clamoring to slay a world his hunger had made. There was a clangor of destruction's wings. The Titan's battle cry was in my ears. Alarm and rumor shook the armored night. I saw the omnipotent's flaming pioneers over the heavenly verge, which turns towards life, come crowding down the amber stairs of birth, forerunners of a divine multitude. Out of the pass of the morning star they came into the little room of mortal life.
I saw them cross the twilight of an age, the sun-eyed children of a marvelous dawn, the great creators with wide brows of calm, the massive barrier breakers of the world and wrestlers with destiny and her lists of will, the laborers in the quarries of the gods, the messengers of the incommunicable, the architects of immortality. Into the fallen human sphere they came, faces that wore the immortal's glory still, voices that commune still with the thoughts of God, bodies made beautiful by the spirit's light, carrying the magic word, the mystic fire, carrying the Dionysian cup of joy, approaching eyes of a diviner man, lips chanting an unknown anthem of the soul, feet echoing in the corridors of time. High priests of wisdom, sweetness, might, and bliss, discoverers of beauty's sunlit ways and swimmers of love's laughing, fiery floods, and dancers within rapture's golden doors. Their tread one day shall change the suffering earth and justify the light on nature's face. Although fate lingers in the high beyond, and the work seems vain on which our heart's force was spent, all shall be done for which our pain was born. Even as of old man came behind the beast, this high divine successor surely shall come behind man's inefficient mortal pace, behind his vain labor, sweat, and blood and tears. He shall know what mortal mind barely durst think. He shall do what the heart of the mortal could not dare. Inheritor of the toil of human time, he shall take on him the burden of the gods. All heavenly light shall visit the earth's thoughts. The might of heaven shall fortify earthly hearts. Earth's deeds shall touch the superhuman's height. Earth's seeing widen into the infinite.
Heavy, unchanged weighs still the imperfect world. The splendid youth of time has passed and failed. Heavy and long are the years our labor counts, and still the seals are firm upon man's soul, and weary is the ancient mother's heart. O truth, defended in thy secret son, voice of her mighty musings in shut heavens on things withdrawn within her luminous depths. O wisdom splendor, mother of the universe, creatrix, the eternal's artist bride. Linger not long with thy transmuting hand pressed vainly on one golden bar of time, as if time dare not open its heart to God. O radiant fountain of the world's delight, world free and unattainable above, O bliss who ever dwellest deep hid within, while men seek thee outside and never find, mystery and muse with hieratic tongue, incarnate the white passion of thy force, mission to earth, some living form of thee. One moment fill with thy eternity. Let thy infinity in one body live. All knowledge wrap one mind in seas of light. All love throb single in one human heart. Immortal, treading the earth with mortal feet, all heaven's beauty crowd in earthly limbs. Omnipotence, girdle with the power of God, movements and moments of a mortal will. Pack with the eternal might one human hour, and with one gesture change all future time. Let a great word be spoken from the heights, and one great act unlock the doors of fate.
His prayer sank down in the resisting night, oppressed by the thousand forces that deny, as if too weak to climb to the supreme. But there arose a wide consenting voice. The spirit of beauty was revealed in sound. Light floated round the marvelous vision's brow, and on her lips the immortal's joy took shape. O strong forerunner, I have heard thy cry. One shall descend and break the iron law, change nature's doom by the lone spirit's power. A limitless mind that can contain the world, a sweet and violent heart of ardent calms, moved by the passions of the gods, shall come. All mights and greatnesses shall join in her. Beauty shall walk celestial on the earth. Delight shall sleep in the cloud net of her hair, and in her body as on his homing tree, immortal love shall beat his glorious wings. The music of griefless things shall weave her charm. The harps of the perfect shall attune her voice. The streams of heaven shall murmur in her lap. Her lips shall be the honeycombs of God, her limbs his golden jars of ecstasy, her breasts the rapture flowers of paradise. She shall bear wisdom in her voiceless bosom. Strength shall be with her like a conqueror's sword, and from her eyes the eternal's bliss shall gaze. A seed shall be sown in death's tremendous hour, a branch of heaven transplant to human soil. Nature shall overleap her mortal step. Fate shall be changed by an unchanging will.
As a flame disappears in endless light, immortally extinguished in its source, vanished the splendor and was still the word. An echo of delight that once was close. An echo of delight that once was close. The harmony journeyed towards some distant hush, a music failing in the ear of trance, a cadence called by distant cadences, a voice that trembled into strains withdrawn. Her form retreated from the longing earth, forsaking nearness to the abandoned sense, ascending to her unattainable home. Lone, brilliant, vacant lay the inner fields. All was unfulfilled in ordinate spirit space, indifferent, waste, a desert of bright peace. Then a line moved on the far edge of calm, the warm-lipped, sentient, soft terrestrial wave. A quick and many-murmured moan and laugh came gliding in upon white feet of sound. Unlocked was the deep glory of silence heart. The absolute unmoving stillness surrendered to the breath of mortal air, dissolving boundlessly the heavens of trance, collapsed to waking mind. Eternity cast down its uncommunicable lids over its solitudes, remote from ken, behind the voiceless mystery of sleep. The grandiose respite failed, the wide release. Across the light of fast receding planes that fled from him as from a falling star, compelled to fill its human house in time, his soul drew back into the speed and noise of the vast business of created things. A chariot of the marvels of the heavens, broad based to bear the gods on fiery wheels, flaming, he swept through the spiritual gates. The mortal stir received him in its midst. Once more he moved amid material scenes, lifted by intimations from the heights and in the pauses of the building brain, touched by the thoughts that skim the fathomless surge of nature and wing back to hidden shores. The eternal seeker in the aeonic field, besieged by the intolerant press of hours, again was strong for great swift-footed deeds.
Awake beneath the ignorant vault of night, he saw the unnumbered people of the stars and heard the questioning of the unsatisfied flood, and toiled with the form maker, measuring mind. A wanderer from the occult invisible suns, accomplishing the fate of transient things. A god in the figure of the arisen beast, he raised his brow of conquest to the heavens, establishing the empire of the soul on matter and its bounded universe as on a solid rock in infinite seas. The Lord of Life resumed his mighty rounds in the scant field of the ambiguous globe. End of Book 3, Canto 4. End of Part 1. I feel reluctant to move on from this magnificence, but I have a secret. I know what's in the next canto, and it draws me on.
I don't have that secret. I don't know what comes next. And this seems like a wonderful place to hang out for a little while. I think we had said that we talked about this being one of the more renowned cantos, let's say, so to speak, amongst readers of Savitri, and that it's kind of packed with gems. It's packed with, it's almost like overflowing with, I love the dialogue, the back and forth. I think this is something that has been less a part of the previous cantos. They're more coming from one voice. And now we have Ashwapati and the mother and this plea which is so majestic that he makes on behalf of humanity. Like we've worked hard, we've endured all the, you can't just leave us hanging here, let's get to the next, let's get to some kind of higher stage or higher place or fulfillment. There's a Christian kind of, these Christian threads that are running through here, I've noticed. This promised one, it has the flavor of a second coming kind of messianic, perhaps, quality. It's a different story, but there's a similar structure. And the Lord of Life is a kind of, in English, is a kind of Christian-tinged term. And this vast night, it's very, it's reminiscent of the time between the crucifixion and the resurrection, which story is also what one could say an archetypal kind of story, and is predates Christianity per se, is like a deep pattern in the human experience, the death and rebirth, and there are phrases here I'd like to emblazon, like somewhere like in front of, like on the door to get into this, into my studio here. Ascend to thy high self, create, endure. Cease not from knowledge, let thy toil be vast. No more can earthly limits pen thy force. Equal thy work with long unending times. These are like thunderbolts of integral injunctions. It all resonates very strongly with me. I think it's the struggle we all, as souls, as living souls, as creative beings, like we all have these challenges, these travails, these ordeals it seems never ending. It seems like there's no rest, nothing will come of the effort. There would be no reward per se, at the end of the, no gold at the end of the rainbow. But I think this canto argues contrary to that notion. Really, I'm glad we read it together. Really enjoyed this.
Like you, Marco, I picked up on the voices this time. I guess in the more fragmented reading that we did they wouldn't really stand out as really independent voices. So I thought that became much more clear to me. And it also reminded me of our reading of Paradise Lost. I was reminded, it's interesting you brought in the Christian themes, because I was reminded of the section in the Garden of Eden when they're talking about, you know, the the forbidden fruit and all of that, and the dialogue that happened between the different had a bit of echoes of that in this text, I thought. I also think it's kind of interesting that we read this whole section during the pandemic. And now we're moving into this other section and we're kind of moving out of the pandemic. So there's a kind of parallel there that's kind of interesting, maybe significant anyway.
I'm just really struck. I love the description when she finally consents. The spirit of beauty was revealed in sound. Light floated round the marvelous vision's brow, and on her lips the immortal's joy took shape. And then she consents.
Maybe she was just waiting for him to ask nicely.
Or ardently enough.
You're right.
I have a kind of a ambiguous feeling towards the famous line, starting with, I saw the omnipotence flaming pioneers over the heavenly verge was turned towards life. I just love it. And yet, if it comes on my turn to read, the feelings that come up make it impossible for me to talk. And so when I'm reading, I got the most of that because Jeffrey stopped, I think three lines before the bottom of page 343. And so I have to stay present in my butt, in my body, so that I can read. Otherwise, all this feeling comes flooding up and I can't talk.
Yeah, I have that with that section where she, on 346, where she speaks and she assents that and then begins to describe Savitri, the mother's embodiment. I remember last time I could barely speak, and even now I have to control my tears that rise because I am so moved. Like the first time we get to see her in form, in a vision.
One thought I had, which I'd like to share, even though it connects to something we were talking about before we started recording, and that's the pandemic. Actually, GJ, you mentioned this as well, that when we say we're out, you know, we're coming out of it, but that's limited to a few states and nations, actually. And for example, India is in the, you know, in the throes, in the thick of a huge wave, and is pretty overwhelmed right now by the pandemic. And other parts of the world have different situations, but I think this is it's easy to forget that, you know, like when just in the relief of being able to go to the grocery store without a mask on, or, you know, being able to see friends who you haven't seen in a long time, or you know, family who you know, you've been separated from for so long. So I want to make sure we like remember that in the space, because part of, I think, what happens in this cosmic adventure is we remember and we forget, and we awaken and then we fall back asleep, and then we have these vaster intuitions of our interconnectedness and interbeing, and then we also contract back to our, you know, narrower spheres, or narrower views, smaller spheres. And part of, I think, what I think this reading, like reading together, does in a way is like keep open the channels, or keep open our, keep our hearts open, really, to the larger vision, like to a larger vision of who and what we are. And, you know, this a lot, you know, we were discussing the last time, I believe, about how some of the language in this canto is a precursor to the awakening in the 60s and the flower children, and these kind of large scale cultural emergences, and like the influx of wisdom teachings, for example, from east to west, and, you know, that also being part of a globalization, a lot of things going on. But it's, I think, part of what the pandemic has, maybe one of the gifts of the pandemic, which is unevenly realized, is that we can now more concretely recognize ourselves as part of a larger human story. And we can, I think, begin, although there's also a backlash to this, but I think it paves the way, or opens the way to, you know, to thinking more in terms of you know, who we are as human beings, and also as cosmic beings, like that this human incarnation, this human moment, this human planetary kind of emergence is one step in a much longer, much grander drama. And if we can hold that in mind, I think it makes it, I think it changes the nature of how we experience our being here on Earth. I think we're going to get closer with the, I hope it will lead us to re-examine our relationship also with the natural world. That's what I think maybe is the shadow side, or the potentially the downside of vaccines, is that they kind of lead us to take for granted the more complex web of relationships that exist between a human organism and the microbial world and other life forms. If we can just kind of give ourselves vaccines and like keep going on the same pace, in the same, on the same path that we were, it could like facilitate more destruction in one sense, you know. But if on the other hand, you know, it opens a space to re-examine like that web and to see how perhaps what makes us vulnerable to large-scale pandemic diseases is partly a result of how we exist or fail to exist ecologically, and you know, how we fail to communicate compassionately or to make ethical choices collectively, not just and individually. I think that we have to keep these sort of visions open, and because they can draw us toward better futures. So, yeah.
Well said, Marco. I keep thinking about something that's might be tangential, but that's been on my mind a lot. Anybody familiar with the name Thomas Hubel? Thomas Hubel, H-U-B-L.
I am.
Yeah, so I just got his book called Healing Collective Trauma. What he's describing in there, he's describing these kind of outbreaks of collective trauma in great, huge gatherings. And he's also familiar with Sri Aurobindo and, of course, Ken Wilber. It seems like what he's describing, the kinds of outbreaks that he's describing in these collective replaying or eruptions of collective trauma, are another outbreak, like potentially another outbreak like the 60s of the shadow with the potential for healing in a really much vaster way than, for example, psychotherapy has looked at before, at least Western psychotherapy, not necessarily other traditions. I don't want to go into a big long discussion of it, but I mean it's Karen and I were gone this weekend to celebrate her birthday. We went to Mendocino, and that was the first time we'd gone somewhere since the pandemic really took hold. And we listened to an interview of him on the way to Mendocino in the car. And it seems like this, he's really onto something big.
Yeah, I think it's quite remarkable that there's a whole movement about dealing with collective trauma that he is kind of spearheading, Thomas Hubel. And quite a number of marvelous, wise and insightful people who are in its vast collaborative that are doing now these workshops because we're now all over the world in terms of like we can be here together, you know, as if we are all in my living room. But that this is happening, this is brought into a collective awareness. And even as, you know, trauma is erupting right at this moment as we speak in Israel and Palestine, the awareness of collective trauma, it's coming. It's beginning to come out and become aware, available to large numbers of people
quite wonderful. Gabor Maté is one of them. Such wise, beautiful beings who are bringing their love and their understanding, the depth of their understanding and compassion to so many of us.
One aspect of Thomas Hubel's work that I'm aware of, I have a good friend who participated in some of it, and who's writing her own book, not on the subject, but sort of more from a personal vantage point, is intergenerational trauma. And one aspect of the collective is that it's also passed on through families and through societies. And Israel-Palestine, perfect example of that, actually. I think what's most, or maybe most more poignant, is that when we realize that our suffering is not purely our own, I mean, it is our own, but who the subject is of that is, it's not just the atomic individual, it really is connected with family and connected with our communities and our nations, but beyond that, because those are it's connected to life, it's connected to being in matter, that's how fundamental it is, like, so. And that's what I think is unique, especially about what Sri Aurobindo and the mother have written about, as I understand it, is the human condition is a condition of being, not merely of our particular kind of beings, but so you know, if we see things in that light, I think it changes like where we put our attention and where we think the healing has to happen. Like, if it's just me healing, I don't think we'll get very far if we try to heal as individuals. Certainly we do have to do that as well. And there's, you know, unique traumas that we as individuals suffer. But when we connect that with others, I think that helps us tell a truer story. It also helps us draw on, it connects us with resources that we otherwise would be isolated from.
I related to what you said, Marco, about it's about being in matter, which is kind of the essence of my own personal soul story about the willingness or unwillingness to be in matter. And when I was listening to Thomas in the interview, I was kind of automatically changing some of his words and some of his perspective to more of an Aurobindonian one, without feeling critical or demeaning of anything that he's doing. It's just a different way of looking at it. But that's one of the things that really inspires me, just to see these things happening that may not have any visible connection to this yoga, but are happening anyway and having and expressing aspects of this vast vision of the collective unity in a very practical and very physical ways. I guess I'm speaking really abstractly, but I'm thinking of individual examples of that, but probably it's probably not the place to discuss it. Looks like we take up part two next time. The first canto is one of my favorite cantos in Savitri.
I suppose that'll be in June, then. This is being the second reading of May. I like what you said, John Robert, about being in matter. And I think it also has to do with mattering, like in that we just slide the meaning a little bit. Mattering meaning, like there's. Being in matter means that we mean, right? Like it lets us mean more than this like uncommitted state. Like there's like a commitment that to being in matter, like you have to stay with it, right? Because the temptation or the tendency is to pull away, it's to abstract, to we want to return to sort of an invulnerable place, a kind of place where we don't have to hit up against other bits of matter. And I know that story too, I think, but you know, it's taken a lot of philosophy just to get to like simple things, you know, just to get to like the simple facts. That's maybe just the like our particular problem. It's not everyone's problem necessarily. How are you all feeling about, should we maybe wrap it up early? And we still, you know, technically have time, but I don't really want to feel like doing a lot of analysis. I almost forgot that we were doing this morning because I was sort of just wrapped up in not even concerns. I was just, as we discussed before we started recording, I really enjoying my life, and, which I haven't fully really done in quite some time. The tastes of that are really delicious. You know, it's like.
Yeah, I agree. I am in the same boat. There's a lot of delight. I would just like to mention the things matter. Big matter, matter, mother. Mattering is mothering. It's like it is here. It is in. It's so essential that we do this work in the body. And therefore, the trauma work is also so essential. And for each one of us individually, we do it for ourselves. But the result is that we are inseparate from the totality. So whatever healing I can somehow invite in my body is part of the larger body of humanity. I contribute. I have felt and seen that for a very long time. Everyone who does a piece of their own healing is doing this for humanity and for the generations, you know, before and after. Because we're all in one field.
And offering it to humanity is part of the healing too.
Yeah.
And receiving it from those who are still in trauma. So it comes back to your comment about India and Palestine and stuff. Because we're still receiving their trauma as well, since we're all part of the same thing.
And we can expand our love to them, you know, to that part of the world.
I was also thinking about the fact that when we read aloud these texts, it's like we enter, it's like we almost make a, not sure what the word is, but a commitment or an engagement with their listeners, but also with the time process of reading aloud. I feel a little bit when I'm reading aloud that I'm in a tunnel and I have to move forward through this tunnel in order to get to the end of, but that's a kind of going down into matter as well. This is the reading aloud is an entering into a density of some sort, right? That, and so it has a lot of that invocation kind of feeling to it, I think.
It resonates in the physical realm, right? In matter.
If we let it, if we invite it and let it do so. And I think that that's something I've been almost relying on, is that one could read one word at a time. Like the words are there, right? And it's not, you know, in the kind of way that we've been educated, or many of us have been educated, I certainly was educated, is you try to read fast to get as much information as possible in the shortest amount of time, right? And so I think that leads to this tendency to want to kind of get it and move on, like get the meaning and move on. Whereas one word at a time, and then the flow from word to word to word, and this is the poetic art of the poet Sri Aurobindo in this case, is to make that all work really wonderfully so that you don't need to understand it all. You just need to be in it. And the meaning reveals itself. It unfolds progressively. And so I think this tunnel effect, it's like a tunneling, and it opens up too. This has been a, you know, this is, for me, has been a very educational exercise. Every time we talk and reflect on the text and meta reflect on our process, you know, I realize things I may have intuited at one point or another, or glimpsed, but then articulated, and that makes it available in a way just for to work with, just for the understanding. This last line, we talked about it last time, but it comes back to me again, this ambiguous globe that he leaves us with at the end of the canto. That's, I think, one of the things that makes the poem really work, is that it never is black and white. It never is either or. There's always this open-endedness, you know, and this sort of resistance to a kind of like static resolution. I think that's appropriate, you know, that's apropos to where we are in this larger context. So I think that's all I want to say, but thank you so much. And
thank you.
Yeah, and we're going to meditate a little bit too, right?
Oh, sorry. That was okay.
Thank you, everybody. Wonderful canto. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Marco, can you remind me if we have an editorial meeting today? I'm a bit confused.
Next week.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. Okay.
All right. Enjoy your afternoon and evening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.